Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you, everybody. Thanks for being here with us today. Sunday morning wake-up call. Important topics. International Rescue Committee, refugees, immigrants. Harriet Kaur, Executive Director of the Charlottesville and Richmond offices. Harriet, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Fine? Excellent?
You know, it's a little rainy, drizzly morning here, but so far so good. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Well, I appreciate that because I'm happy to be here with you. I'm always pleased and excited when people take time out on a Sunday morning, rain or not, to get out of bed, enjoy their breakfast, and come over here to be with us live on the Sunday morning wake-up call. 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Does the International Rescue Committee fall into the progressive voice of the world? Or are you just happy, are you just happening to be on the progressive voice station?
Let's say we're non-political in the sense of we consider the work we do bipartisan, that it's for the good of the country, not in line with any political party. And you know, the work we do with refugees traditionally has always had bipartisan support from both sides of the aisle. We're finding ourselves falling into some different areas and different classifications now with some of the changes we're seeing.
I feel like that's going to answer a question that I'm going to ask later on in the hour, but I'll ask it anyway. So, but let's get started. Harriet is the executive director of the Charlottesville and Richmond offices in our area, the International Rescue Committee. So let me just jump right in. The difference, please give me the difference, the definition of a refugee versus an immigrant, because mm-hmm. we hear that a lot, both terms tossed around, whether we hear that politically from the steps in Washington or just in the news.
Mm-hmm. So we could say there's different ways to come to the United States if you're coming in from another country, and you can start from the broader classification. If you're entering legally, you're documented, you're entering either as an immigrant or a non-immigrant, and that's a different thing, you know, the kind of visas people get. So non-immigrant would be someone coming to study or to visit, or, you know, just coming to go to Disney World. An immigrant means someone entering with the intention possibly of staying or working on a path towards permanent residency. Refugees are a subclassification of immigrants, and refugees enter under a special humanitarian status. They actually don't get visas in the traditional way that most other people enter. They are granted this humanitarian status because of what's happened to them. They still come in, obviously, with a lot of vetting and scrutiny and paperwork and documentation. But it's that. And the key part or key thing to remember is that refugees are granted that status based on a documented claim of persecution. So when I first came to Charlottesville, I would hear people say things like, oh, you know, there's been an earthquake. I guess we're going to get refugees from XYZ. And that's not true. You can't become a refugee because of an economic situation or what's happening in your country, a natural disaster. It has to be based on a persecution claim. You have to be able to say, I mean, and the key thing, I mean, you have left your home. You have to be outside of your home country. You fled your native country, and you're basically saying, I can't return to my, if I return to my home country, I will be in danger. And then the law actually gives like certain classifications due to my ethnicity, my political beliefs, my social group, you know, there's kind of my religion, you know, different classifications that you are a member of some persecuted group.
So people from Haiti, because of the earthquakes, et cetera, cannot come to the U.S.
They would not.
They cannot be refugees.
Right. That's why they got that special, that other kind of status, the TPS that you've heard people talk about. So there are other ways of getting people. And that was always technically a temporary status, temporary protected status. But refugees enter based on documentation that they are unable to return to their home country safely and securely, and that there's no other viable alternative for them. They may have fled to another country that also will not grant them any kind of rights or ability to make a future for themselves. And then, you know, they eventually become eligible to what we call third country resettlement, go to a third country such as the United States to find a new future for themselves. So when refugees enter the U.S., they're on a path to citizenship. They're required to apply for green cards for legal permanent residence after a year, and they're eligible for to apply for citizenship after 5 years.
But must they apply for citizenship?
No. It's always they're required to apply for the legal permanent residence to they call that adjusting their status to something that's you know, they get the card and they're on a thing where, you know, and with that, you know, every 5 or 10 years you're checking in and reapplying. But citizenship is always a choice. Becoming an American citizen is always a choice.
What if they're here for, I don't know, 15 years?
Yeah.
Can you stay for 15 years or 20 years or 25 years?
Have you ever gone to the July 4th ceremony?
I have.
Always somebody who stands up and says, yeah, I've been here for like 25 years, but it just seemed like now was the right time to become a citizen because of XYZ. And so once you're a legal permanent resident, you, as long as you renew, you have to renew that status, I think, like every 10 years. And as long as you do that and you stay in status and you don't do anything like really bad, you can stay. But, you know, it's citizenship is the ultimate protection because even as a legal permanent resident, you could stay here for the rest of your life, but you can still be deported, right? You can, if you commit a crime or something, you can still, or something happens or you fall out of status technically, you know, and of course you can't vote. There's still certain things you can't do that you have to become a citizen to do.
No, I was working with someone who was a close friend at the time, and she and her husband became citizens on July 4th, and they invited a few of us.
Mm-hmm.
That was an amazing time. I'd never been before, and I haven't been since, but that was a great day.
It's one of my favorite things to do every year. Yeah. I go every year.
you go because...
Well, we have obviously...
Because you have folks.
We have folks, but I have that extra reason, but I still love it. It's a great way to spend the 4th of July.
Yeah, Harriet Kaur here from the International Rescue Committee. One of the things that I want to talk about throughout the hour are the changes of things since the Trump administration took over. We have some of which will be apparent, the travel ban, the refugee DACA.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a couple others that I'm not sure that our listeners will be quite as aware of. So let's start with one of those. There's the CAM program, the Central American Minors Refugee and Parole Program.
Mm-hmm.
Since December of 2014, the CAM program, again, the Central American Minors Refugee and Parole Program, has helped reunite children fleeing gang violence in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador who had parents already in the USA legally. The children were coming up from those Central American countries, find their parents who were already in the United States legally.
So it's a little different. So if you put your mind back about 5 years when we had these kids coming over the border, over the southern border, it was kind of out of control. Remember, all these children were unaccompanied. We call them unaccompanied minors or unaccompanied alien children, right? That were coming over the border. It was about 5 years ago, in very uncontrolled way, and they were trying to stash these kids in different places and figure out what to do with them all. And you know, that's sort of hard to control, but within the refugee program, the people that kind of work on that, there was a decision to try and see if there was something we could do to alleviate that. And you know, one of the points about the refugee program is we call it, it's an orderly departure program. I'm going to take this sideways just a little bit, but you know, I have learned that with a lot of the imagery and the visuals that have come in about the refugee program, like pictures of dinghies landing on the beaches of Europe and things like that, that imagery sticks with people and they think that's what's happening in the U.S. And no one's landing dinghies of refugees on the, well, except what the people coming in over our southern border.
Well,
mine
is, I think I heard a story on NPR about kids riding on top of the trains.
Right. So exactly through the southern border. But the U.S. refugee program is all about orderly planned entry, not, I'm talking about specifically about the refugee program. So within the refugee program, they were like, what can we do to address this and try and do something that's orderly and planned and vetted and kind of monitored? And so what they were able to do was launch a program called CAM, the Central American Minors Program. The parents had to be legally present in the U.S. But like the refugee program, all the screening and vetting of the children was done in their home country. So this was not a program for the kids who were just entering illegally. So this was a way for a parent who was here to come in and say, I would like to file for my children to join me. You know, they had to be, you know, unmarried, under 21 or whatever. And then the kids could go to probably the U.S. embassy in whatever country they were at. And like the parent would file the application here. The paperwork would be sent down. The kids would come in, be interviewed, be checked, and be vetted. And then, and a lot of the, so one of the concerns that a lot of, I think, human rights people in this country have is that a lot of these children that were coming in are technically, they meet the criteria of a refugee. I mean, they may or may not, but they may meet the criteria of being able to document persecution that would make them eligible to be a refugee. So part of that program was to bring the kids and screen them. In some situations, if they had to, the threshold for documentation is high. They had to be able to show that they had been threatened or something. They may actually qualify to enter as part of the U.S. refugee program. But then the children that were ineligible, they didn't quite meet that high bar. If they could meet a lower bar, which was to enter with the status of a parolee, a parole status, which is a status that we use, for example, for a lot of Cubans. You know, when Cubans just arrive in the U.S., they're given a status. It's a parole status, which means it's a temporary admittance. You're legal, and then after a year, you apply. You know, you can apply for a green card. So this program was a way to kind of put order on disorder, but give people a way to enter. You know, bring their children legally to protect them and to rejoin with them. And so we had been doing, you know, a lot of the people, parents who applied, were people with this temporary protective status, but some of them with other kinds of status. And so that program was going on, and the administration decided to suspend the program with 24 hours notice.
When you say that, you're talking about the Trump administration.
Yes.
In August of this year.
Just sent out a notice and said, CAM ends tomorrow, like that. And so anyone in the, you know, process of doing the application, and keep in mind, like, these applications, like, the parents had to do DNA tests to prove that the children were really their children and things like that. It was a very elaborate, carefully designed screening program. But basically, if this, you know, if the kid, you know, was, it wasn't like approved by the embassy with like a stamp in their passport, everything stopped. And a lot of these were parents who had been working on this for like a year or two to make this happen. It was 24 hours and it's done. So it was really, really hard. And then of course, what we, that came before then later that we found out that, you know, they were withdrawing the temporary protective status of a lot of the parents too, which was not, you know, like I said, not the way they were all, not the status they all had, but the way many of them were here legally. So that came afterwards.
What does IRC, how does IRC work with this? You know, what was International Rescue Committee doing to participate with the CAM program all along?
So mostly the way is, so most of our offices, we offer immigration services. So we have, they're called accredited representatives who help people file immigration applications. It's for, you know, legal immigrants. And so we had been doing quite a lot of outreach to the Hispanic community to tell them about this program. Like, don't let your kids come on the roof of a train. You can bring them legally. Not in Charlottesville, we only had a very few. We had some applicants, a few, but some of our offices in areas with really significant Hispanic populations had done a lot of work and had taken in quite a lot of applications. So we were, and then if the children came with refugee status, they would come through us and receive all of our services. We don't serve parolees. But, you know, we still were helping people with the paperwork, making sure it was all done properly, making sure it was all, you know, exactly that they were following all the steps, providing all the proper documentation. So we were kind of overseeing this whole process and working with the parents who so much wanted to be rejoined with their children.
And what did IRC do after the Trump administration canceled the program?
You know, there's not, for us, there's not a whole lot to be done because, I mean, obviously there's advocacy and there's, you know, our leadership would, you know, would make press statements or get in the media and inform people what's happening. But there's, you know, it's not a congressional program there. You know, there wasn't a whole lot to do. And then at that point, it was more about protecting, trying to at least protect the rights of the parents and get them the correct information. But there, you know, there was precious little to be done besides raise a voice and outcry.
Do you say we're going to have a march on August 30th?
So keep in mind that as our organization in implementing the refugee program, we receive significant public funding, right? So we are also recipients of federal and state funding to do these programs. So we have an advocacy branch that works on those things, and we also participate to some extent here, but we also have to be very careful because we're also implementers of federal programming.
It must be difficult to accept federal funding while on occasion being against federal decisions.
Actually, I think that's not unusual, probably. Because, you know, political winds change and you're used to doing things one way and often we want to see things change to make them better. So, but, you know, there are also very strict rules about lobbying and what's appropriate, but within our organization, but, you know, as a larger organization, we have different branches and we're able to work together and find ways to lift our voices that are appropriate.
Rules against lobbying. I'm not laughing at the IRC, but I think that there are many organizations that ignore rules against lobbying. Harriet Kaur here from the IRC International Rescue Committee, Executive Director of the Charlottesville and Richmond office. When I come back, I want to ask when we got a Richmond office, because that wasn't always the case. We'll be right back 20 minutes after the hour. And here we are back with Harriet Kaur, the executive director of the Charlottesville and the Richmond office.
Yes.
When did we open? Because I think those who are listening here live on 94.7 WPVC and the podcast, SevoPodcast.com, everybody who's been around for a while knows that there's an IRC office in Charlottesville. Yeah. When did we get a Richmond office?
And you know, we've been here in Charlottesville. We're celebrating our 20th year.
Wow.
We opened the office here in 1998.
Congratulations.
Yeah. But I had an opportunity in 2015. We had an opportunity to get some state funding that allowed us to open an office. There's already two other resettlement agencies in Richmond. Commonwealth Catholic Charities and Church World Service are operating. But, you know, it's a major metropolitan area, and the capacity was there. So we opened, it's a sub-office. Our Richmond office is a sub-office to Charlottesville, which people in Richmond scratch their heads. But yeah, I always say everybody in Charlottesville thinks that makes total sense. So we opened, it's a smaller office, much smaller than what we have here, but growing rapidly. And it's been really exciting because, you know, Richmond is a, I've found it, there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of interest in the work we do there, and just a lot of opportunity to do new things. And, you know, we've been focusing on some really interesting programs down there.
And you're the executive director of both.
Right. So, yeah, Richmond's a sub-office of Charlottesville, technically. Yeah. That's how it operates in our structure.
I think that just shows the quality work that you do.
Well, thank you.
Again, Harriet Kaur here from the International Rescue Committee as we talk about the work that the IRC does. So let's talk about some other changes in immigrant and refugee rules, federal and state rules and regulations since the Trump administration took over. Let's talk about the historically low refugee caps that have taken place.
Yeah, shockingly low, yes.
It used to be, I guess, since 1980, I saw this on the IRC website, and I see my poor work for the day. What is the website?
IRC's website?
Yeah.
Rescue.org.
Rescue.org. Yeah. Don't use IRC. You get some other. It's
rescue.org. Rescue.org.
Rescue.org. Says that the average since 1980 is 95,000 refugees a year. That's the average since 1980. Until the Trump administration changes that on September 27th and sets a cap of 45,000.
Right.
But then now the current actual projection for 2018 is going to be closer to 22,000.
We think. So let's the way refugee entrance, the kind of the refugee program operates, it's a presidential determination. So every year, the way the legislation is, every year the president has to sign a determination for how many refugees will enter the coming year, the coming fiscal year.
And let's again, the definition of refugees are based on humanitarian status and persecution in other countries.
Exactly. And the program is the refugee admissions program is run by the State Department. It's kind of handled in a different way because of the humanitarian role and the way it plays into other foreign policy kind of decisions. You know, because the people that are working on bringing refugees to the U.S. are, it's the same part of the State Department that sends emergency aid and, you know, helps people in refugee camps in other countries. It's sort of part of a whole humanitarian mission. And so the president, the way the legislation is read, that the president is supposed to consult with the State Department and then also with Congress. And then, so you have all three branches of government involved in this, and then determines the appropriate number to set for the coming year. So, and it goes up and down or according to need, but until this year, the lowest number that was ever set was 1 year during the Reagan administration. The cap was set at 65,000. So not only is this less, it's dramatically less. And what I think that the tactic is to set it at a historically low number, 45,000, but then immediately to try putting into place different measures through executive order and policy changes that then make sure that, in fact, there's no way to even get to the 45,000, but kind of do it through these policy changes so it's kind of not, you know, you're not out there saying what you're doing. But that's the effect we're seeing. So between all the travel bans and the, you know, banned countries and all of this and changes in application processes and things like that, it's slowed down the system so much. And it, you know, because it takes so long for someone to go through that process of getting to the U.S., it's slowed everything down so much that we don't see how we would ever get to 45,000 by September 30th, the end of the fiscal year.
And our guest today, Harriet Kaur from the International Rescue Committee's Charlottesville and Richmond offices. This is 94.7 WPVC's Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I mean, I was going to say, but I think the tragedy of all of this is there's never been a time in history since the beginning of that program that there's a greater need to allow people a safe harbor. You know, this is a time of the highest numbers of displaced persons since the end of World War II, and yet we're you know, locking the door.
Well, that's a question for you is, haven't there been greater times? Didn't we need, wasn't there time during World War II or the Vietnam War when we actually needed, when other countries were actually had more persecuted folks and that needed to come over. This is there's a few other people out there that need places, but the United States doesn't need to give them a home.
Well, I think that we would say that the United States needs to do its fair share, because we're obviously not the only country that people come to, and there are plenty of countries around the world that participate and take in asylum seekers or refugees. But traditionally, you know, we say, I think the latest numbers, there's about 23 million refugees in the world. It's hard to wrap your head around that number, but those are people who are outside of their home country, unable to return, living in some kind of state of limbo, wherever they are. 23 million. Out of that number, only about 1% ever get the opportunity to be safely resettled in a third country. And traditionally, out of that 1%, the U.S. takes about half. So right now, our other, you know, partner countries are way outdoing us helping. But we're basically taking away hope from people who have nothing else to look forward to in their lives. It's a real human tragedy.
I found some myths on the rescue.org website. Refugees are a drain on society.
Yeah. I think there's this a pretty common belief that people come here and basically they are entitled to access to, they're able to get some of the same benefits that Americans get. Most immigrants have to actually, in order to enter the U.S., most immigrants have to sign a waiver saying that they won't, they're ineligible for any kind of benefits for at least 5 years after they arrive. because of their humanitarian status, refugees get a waiver on that they are eligible. So I think there's this idea that they're kind of coming and getting all these public benefits. One of the interesting things was it with the very first travel ban from last January, a year ago, one of the things there was administration asked to have a study done of the economic contribution. Well, basically what they asked for was how much does it cost America to resettle refugees? And they sent that off to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is a part of Health and Human Services. It's a government agency. They crunched their numbers and came back with a report that said, well, refugees do use public benefits at a rate that does not exceed what a similar population of Americans would use. And that they do use those during their first 5 years in the U.S. But if you look at by the time they've been here 10 years, they're contributing back more than the cost of their own resettlement. And that report, they handed that report out. It was immediately quashed. But this is what we know that, and so I it's very difficult for me because I feel like the narrative that is being pushed is that immigrants, including refugees, are takers. They're here to take from Americans. And what I know and we know is that in fact immigrants are supporting our country. They're contributing to our economy. They're, you know, contributing to, we need more young people here to help take care of all of us aging baby boomers. You know, there's a lot that they're contributing back. We know that immigrants start small businesses at a greater rate than native born Americans.
Well, it's not just that they're takers.
They're building
also,
our society.
They're also dangerous, right? The refugees that come over are also male Muslim terrorists.
Yeah.
That's also what I saw as myths on the refugee.com website.
And they're about two thirds of refugees are women and children. We do obviously get single men, very, very few. It's mostly families, and they're very carefully vetted, very, very carefully screened. But we also know, and you had made prior allusion to the Refugee Act of 1980, which was what kind of formally created this program. We know that since 1980, over 3 million refugees have entered the U.S. and that no American has died at the hands of a refugee. 3 million people, nothing has happened. And I'm not sure you could take 3 million members of the general American-born population and make the same statement. So these are, you know, not generous. And I think this whole idea that because they're coming from war-torn countries, that means that they're like gun-toting, you know. But these are the people who are running away from violence. They are not running towards it. These are people who know what real violence looks like and what, you know, fear of dying every day looks like, and they want to get as far away from that as possible. They're not perpetrators. They're the victims that want to get away. I don't think I feel safer around around the refugees than around just about anybody else.
Our guest today, Harriet Kaur, she's the executive director of the Charlottesville and Richmond offices for International Rescue Committee, 35 minutes after the hour. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. Harriet, let's talk about the IRC for a few minutes. We talked about vetting refugees, and you mentioned that majority of them are women and children.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are singles.
Yeah.
Is there a difference in getting through the system? Are there differences in how a probable outcome might take place?
Probably, you know, that, so the, when we talked before about how, you know, US, we call the orderly departure program. one of the things is because the U.S. and the size of our program, you know, what happens in Europe, or like when you see people talking about like England or Germany or something, they bring people in as asylum seekers, and then they go through that vetting and review process after they're in that host country. Because of the size of the U.S. program, we do all that outside the country, right? So we have processing centers, or, you know, in Bangkok and Jordan and other countries around the world. So all of the refugee screening and interviews and everything happens before, you know, before they're ever allowed to enter the U.S. And one of the things we know, or, you know, I know, is that there are plenty of people who apply who get turned down. I don't have inside information on it. Like, we never see that inside this country, but clearly not everyone who applies to a program is accepted into the program. And then once accepted, they go through this very, very rigorous process of security screenings, and everyone has to have a face-to-face interview by an officer from Department of Homeland Security overseas. They have to have that before they can come in. There's different scrutiny. Mostly right now, it's according to where you're coming from. So if you're coming from one of the kind of Middle Eastern countries or countries seen at a higher risk for terrorism, there's a whole lot more levels of security checks and things that people have to do. But it's extremely rigorous. We know that refugees are already more carefully vetted and screened than any other category of immigrant in order to get in the country. So sort of targeting the refugees as the most dangerous is ironic, because they are already screened. Syrians are already getting iris scans. And this was way before, this was under the Obama administration. You know, all these really careful checks had already been put into place. And I mean, they're kind of run through all the databases of all these, you know, all the different security agencies. What was the rest of the question?
I'm curious if, if it's a woman and, and three kids, would that group be more likely to get through the system than one male?
You know, that I don't know, because I think it's really more based on your individual screening and the results of your interviews and your security screens and things like that. There is, within the refugee system, there is a prioritization system. So for example, a widowed woman with three children would get prioritized to the program because of the risk of her inability, perhaps where she is, to be able to economically support her family, for example. A family with a child who had some kind of severe medical issues. You know, there are systems of prioritizing who gets out first based on their risk. I mean, their risk to themselves, not political risk, but their need, based on their need. And so that, I think there would be that. I don't know the inside outs of what happens before.
Again, our guest today, Harriet Kaur, on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, talking about refugees and immigrants and the changes since the Trump administration took over on various programs. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, and we're going to talk about the travel bans, DACA, and a few other things that go on at the IRC. Hang tight. And thank you for being here with us today, 40 minutes after the hour. Always happy to have our guest with us live in the studio, Harriet Kaur, with us. Harriet, you had an op-ed back in the Daily Progress not too long ago, earlier in the month of February 2018. So let's talk about President Trump's travel ban. He started that almost immediately upon taking his taking office.
It was a week after taking office.
Week after taking office in 2017. Title of your op-ed, new immigration policies have been devastating. What did the IRC do to fight the ban? Because it's really been in sort of three or four layers.
Well, there was the initial ban challenged in court. Then there was the second one challenged in court. Then there's been different pieces of it, and it's been so complicated. It's been actually really, really hard to keep up with all the different permutations and the different courts and the different stays and the overturning.
Assume that the IRC participated in the court in some way. I mean, maybe not standing side by side at the tables, but I'll assume that they were saying, "Hey, we need to take this to court." But was did the IRC participate? What did the IRC do to the people who were affected by the travel ban?
I think most of the court cases did not come from refugee agencies because they needed people who were immediately affected, right? So I think my memory is like the early ones, it was universities who couldn't get their students and researchers. And then family members who, right? So it was people, American citizens who were waiting for relatives to come. So it had to be, you wanted people who had been immediately damaged as opposed to people who might be theoretically damaged. Okay. That I don't remember if IRC ever did any amicus briefs, but there were also, you know, there's nine national networks of refugees. We're one of nine networks. And then there's kind of an umbrella organization that keeps all the refugee resettlement agencies organized. And I know that there was a lot of like letters going and things like that. I will say IRC, you know, we have a really wonderful advocacy team in DC, and they have been like heroes. They have just been amazing at getting out and speaking. And we've been doing, you know, one of the things that happened this year is we've created, trying to do a lot of grassroots organizing, getting our volunteers and our kind of people who support us to take action, to write letters to their congressmen, to make calls. We've actually even started a second website called IRCaction.org where people can register, and if there's legislation or something coming, they'll send them alerts and encourage them to call their congressional representatives. You know, so there's been a lot, and then a lot of it has been media getting, you know, members of our leadership out explaining, like, you know, telling the truth about what this really means and what the motivations are, and just really trying to make sure that the other side, our side, gets heard. And so we've been, I mean, this last year has been like this whirlwind of action, because it's, I mean, there's outrage, but then you have to make your outrage constructive, right? So I'm not so sure we were necessarily involved specifically in the court cases, but we were always there behind explaining and making sure that people that know about us know what's really going on.
You title that op-ed devastating.
It was their title, but that was... I wrote the piece, so the Daily Progress made the title. But yes, it is devastating. I wouldn't disagree with it.
So, as it, I mean, the travel ban is put out there, and then it's, and keep correcting me as I make a wrong statement make another wrong statement.
It's pretty confusing,
but it's put out there, and it's immediately denied, and so then they make another change. And that's denied, and then another change, and the courts deny that, and then another change, and I think the Supreme Court has allowed that one
back. Yeah.
While it is in the court system.
Mm-hmm.
But the current one, which I believe is the fourth attempt is been allowed by the Supreme Court while the current appeals court is looking at it.
Well, so yeah, so the Supreme Court sent it back, but there's still a stay even against that one that allows the bona fide relatives, that the phrase used, the bona fide relatives can still come.
But, which is like the grandparents.
Yeah, then they define that. Like, right. I don't even know, because now with this version, I'm not even sure, but close relatives.
Right, whoever the close relatives are. Right, it's the grandparents and the first cousins, but not the second cousins and
well, and you know, the original version under the administration was that, you know, grandparents were not allowed. But anyhow, I mean, we're now under a thing where it's not even clear if spouses can come. You know, there's so many different permutations. But I mean, what I can say is the chaos of not even having a clear policy that you implement and that you know what to do about, the chaos of all of, you know, all of the changes, the stays and the rewriting and the stays and the rewriting and stays and rewriting, it was devastating and has been devastating on the refugee program. So when, what we know is when their refugees have to, their vetting process is so elaborate, and it's security checks. It's also medical checks. There's other kinds of things that, and even on security checks, they're doing multiple checks and multiple clearances that in order, you know, kind of once all of those things only are good for a certain period of time. They may be good for a year or 6 months. I think most of them are good for 6 months, and they do all these things in sequence that the period when they can legally depart and enter is like, it's like a 6 week window. And so what happens as all of these changes and you know, they can go, they can't go, they can go, they can't go, is even if this person like has gone through all the checks at a certain point, then those checks start to expire and they all have to be redone, which takes like another 6 months. So that's one of the things that even now we're seeing is that the disruption in itself basically keeps people from being able to travel because the process itself is so elaborate that once you disrupt it, it's hard to keep it moving forward. And so that we, you know, that's what we experienced last year. I think last year we, in the end, managed to get 54,000 refugees in, but it was by hook and by crook. But the other thing I want to say is with that first travel ban, the one from last January, I think it's people really were well aware of the ban on like certain countries and you know, some of the different things, but there were refugee provisions in that that I think got a lot less attention. So at that time, it was a suspension. It was a complete suspension of the refugee program for 120 days of any country, anybody coming from any country, whilst quote-unquote security, you know, procedures were being reviewed. So when that was signed, I think it was January 27th, at that point, we went in, I think you could like, people could enter if they were like on the airplane, but basically there was an almost immediate suspension. Then there was the stay. And so people were traveling again. And then every time with each version of the travel ban, that 120 day thing, it took until July. But in July, we had a complete 120 day suspension of the refugee program that went from like July to October. Or was September? Yeah. From like, I guess it was late June through October, with the exception of, so that the exception being bona fides, meaning if someone could still travel if they were a close relative, we squeezed a few people in that way. But most people, you know, some people could travel, but not many. So we had to go through even all of that. And so, you know, it's been very, very devastating. And now, you know, the last version is, you know, the 11 banned countries, 9 majority Muslim, right? And out of those countries, we've estimated that about 44% of likely refugee arrivals come from those, you know, those banned countries, because it includes Syria and Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, all countries that we do receive a lot of refugees from. Those, not from those countries directly, but from those nationalities. So it's really hard. And even knowing that some of these, like, for example, some of the Iraqis are Iraqis who became refugees because they supported the American mission in Iraq.
How many people who work with you or work in the IRC office come to you and cry regularly because of something that the Trump administration has done?
I'll tell you something.
Or curse.
I had a really interesting experience right after the first travel ban. I had a staff member who is a former refugee, has been here for 20 years, come into my office, burst into tears, and say, and she said, "This is how it started in my country." And I'm getting goosebumps right, but this is how it started. This is how the war started in my country. This is how the discrimination and why I had to flee my country. She said, "This is how it started in my country." I think mostly for the refugees who were here. I mean, there was that initial fear, and we did have a meeting with our clients, you know, probably about this time last year, to reassure them that they had entered legally, that status would not, you know, really couldn't be revoked. They had certain rights. They're not the rights of a citizen, but they still have certain rights here, and not to be afraid. So I think the people who are already here after a year sort of understand that they still have protection, but the struggle for them is being separated from their families. That separation is the source of amazing amounts of anguish by our families.
Harriet Kaur from the International Rescue Committee here in Charlottesville, the office in Charlottesville. Another change since Donald Trump took office is about DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. He announced on September 5th that he was going to end that program. Do you think that, and nothing has happened since then, that was going to, there have been multiple conversations about what was going to be done and opportunities to fix that or do something about it. Do you think that that's just been procrastination, planned political survival? What do you talk about that for a few minutes?
We work with that program in other IRC offices through our immigration services. We didn't really get that involved in it here in Charlottesville because we have Legal Aid and Symbaris. We have two other wonderful organizations that really took care of that. But we definitely see ourselves as having common cause with DACA. And for us, it's about protecting the rights of people that are here to contribute and to build America, and what kind of a signal that sends when we turn our backs, you know, on young people and people that just want to help us, you know, help make our country better. I'm perhaps not in the best position to analyze the politics of it all. Trying to read the tea leaves from Congress is not my area of expertise, but I'm assuming that the struggle, you know, it is that sort of struggle back and forth between, you know, they're here illegally, you know, this kind of very strict interpretation of the law and wanting to reach out to young people who've shown themselves to be of good faith, and that kind of back and forth between two sets of beliefs. It's really hard I would say in our current political climate, it's very difficult to find middle ground on things. And I'm thinking that that's probably the struggle.
One of the just a few minutes left here with you to talk about the International Rescue Committee. The events in Charlottesville back on August 11th and 12th. How did those events affect our local refugees and immigrants?
I think in some ways they did better than the rest of us did, because I know, our messaging was, just stay home that day. Don't stay away. And I know that the mosque here did quite a lot of messaging, and they just told people to go home and stay home. Those protesters definitely have the capacity to have immigration that, I always tell people, it's like, we don't like African Americans, we don't like Jews, we don't like, and about third down the list would have been immigrants. Somehow they only got to the first and the second one this time around. But we know that if those kind of, if they come back, immigrants could very well be the next target. So that's been really difficult. I will say the community has been totally amazingly supportive. And a lot of people reached out to us knowing that the immigrants and the refugees and other immigrants could really be at risk and could be endangered. So we've learned a lot about protecting ourselves.
So I want to know, is there an event coming up that people can go to?
In a little bit longer, but in the summer, in June, we have our annual fundraising event the first week in June. And this year we're also planning to do a community-wide event for World Refugee Day, which is every year on June 20th. We're going to be celebrating is the wrong word. We're going to be recognizing it on tentatively on June the 23rd. We're planning something. So we're going to have stuff out in the community. If people are interested, they can go to our webpage. They can sign up for our newsletter or our Facebook page. We're pretty easy to find, IRC in Charlottesville. Our page off of the main IRC page, you can just click on Charlottesville, and we'll be putting notices up. But we've got definitely things coming up in the next couple months as the weather gets better.
Excellent. All right. Our guest today, Harriet Kaur, the executive director from the Charlottesville and Richmond offices from the International Rescue Committee. Harriet, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. You can listen again at the cvillepodcast.com site a little later on today. Next week, Sean McCord will be back talking about the Seville book event coming up in just a few weeks. I'll be back in 2 weeks talking about euthanasia. Thank you so much, folks. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.